Welcome to Significance Breed Success. My name is Daniel Pewter, and today you're here with somebody who I've been watching about who they are as a human. I really want to understand leadership from this gentleman. Dr. Scott Jensen is from everything I've seen, I'm impressed. So welcome to the show. Thanks for spending some time with me today.
Daniel, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So I want to start with leadership. Obviously, you've been a medical doctor. Maybe you can give a few different things about your background that you want people to know. But I'm really interested now. Now you're going into politics, but I haven't had too many people here on that are political just because I stay off. But you're one of the guys I've been tracking for the last, I don't know, like 3 to 6 months. And I'm really impressed by how you stand up for yourself, who you are as a human, what you stand for, what you talk about. And I believe it's very authentic from what I've seen. I don't know you personally, but everything I see comes from the heart. Is that a good, from your perspective, good character analysis?
I'd like to think so. Daniel, it seems a little bit self-absorbed for me to claim all the compliments you just paid me, but I try to be authentic. I know that in 1976, approximately, there was a series of books that were commissioned, written by John Jakes, and it was to celebrate the 200 years of American history. And he wrote it, and the first book in this series by John Jakes was The Bastard. And then it was The Rebels and The Warriors. And it walked the reader through an historical fiction, a fictionalized historical account of America. And the main character was a fellow named Philip Kent. And throughout the book, you'd every once in a while see this young man grow to, if you will, an older man. And he oftentimes said, take a stand and make a mark. And I was at the time, I was 22 years old, and the book just really resonated with me. So I've always thought that if at the end of my life, I can look myself in the mirror and say, yes, I took a stand and I made a mark. And sometimes it might not have been my best move. Sometimes it might have been brilliant, but that's how I tried to live my life. And so I think that really has guided me a lot.
So he has some pretty interesting books. I mean, it's Love and War, North and South. Pretty interesting. The Americans.
Yep.
Interesting. So building a team, I find that there are successful people that build teams. I mentioned Dr. Oz right before the show when we were talking, and he's been a mentor of mine. He's poured into me. He spent some time with me. Like, to have a guy at that level is very challenging because he's got a million people that want his effort and time. And so it's been awesome to see what he's done behind the scenes, and not too many people see all the good stuff, but and I've never seen anything negative. And I look at people that have built teams, and I'm impressed. So when you run, obviously you've been in politics for a while. When you ran, when you're running, what do you look for in team members? In like, how do you vet people? How do you recruit people? Obviously people are probably attracted to like who you are as a leader. Not as in a physical attraction, but you know, like ideological or like a cultural, you know, way. How do you do that? Like, how do you spend all your time? You must get 10,000 emails a day. Like, how do you do this? It's crazy.
I've had the good fortune to start a couple of restaurants, and I built a couple of commercial buildings, and then I built my own medical clinics. And so through my business career, I've had the chance to try to hone my skills at as quickly as possible, getting to the heart of a matter. And when you're dealing with people, that means getting to the real stuff. Is the person giving me what they think I want to hear, or are they really being authentic? So a couple things I look for. I look for, is the person willing to focus on someone other than themselves to start with? I think in politics, there are so many people whose most commonly used word is I. I look for people who use the word you. And if they don't use the word you, I'd like to see them use the word we, what we can do together. That's a big deal, I think. I look for people who are willing to be self-deprecating and not necessarily self-absorbed. And I think when I was trying to build a team, one of the things that I thought was sort of the magic moment with a lot of people I was working with was when I would, in some given instant or moment, I would say, well, that was my fault, or that was on me. And oftentimes it may not really have been totally on me. It maybe was something that I was peripherally aware of and I didn't step up and fix it. But if I'm willing to say, hey, that's on me, I think you create a culture where people will own up to the mistakes they make. And the mistake isn't the important thing. The important thing is that it got recognized and that we fix it. I remember when I was building this one building and I came in the morning to inspect the steelwork that had been put up the night before, the day before. And there was an odd cutout in a base plate of a steel beam. And so when the contractor came on site a few hours later, I went out and I met with him and I said, could you show me this? Explain to me what happened here. It just looked odd. And he looked and he gave me this wry smile. And without flinching, he said, oh, that's a mistake. He said, that was on me. He said, I gave my workers the wrong instructions. They did exactly what I told them to do. And it wasn't right. I'd read it wrong on the blueprints. And he said, so now what I got to do is I've got to have it welded over 3 times. I have to have it ultrasounded to make sure the welds are as strong or better than the steel beam would have been. And then I have to have an independent contractor come out and demonstrate that, yes, it's been appropriately remedied. He said, I'll take care of it. No charge to you. I've never forgotten that. And that was 20 years ago. I just think that you need to empower people. And one of the best ways to empower them is to let them know that making a mistake isn't the big deal. The big deal is identifying it and fixing it. Because if you're not willing to identify it, fix it, and all you want to do is run from it, I don't want you on my team.
Well, I think if we had leaders, not just in politics, but in the regular world do that, the whole world would shift pretty quick.
I think so. I do.
So Senate, you started off in the Senate in the political world in 2016. You were there for 4 years. I mean, and I see you were doing some stuff with potentially with what I've read is the drug price increase. It's pretty interesting how pharmaceuticals today, I mean, I'm about to launch a medical business because a lot of my students are in our schools are not provided with really good medical care. And what I've heard from my brother, who's a psychiatrist and pediatricians, is it's very hard to get to have youth practices or under 18-year-old practices in financial challenged neighborhoods because or neighborhoods that speak multiple languages, because sometimes the doctors don't speak those languages. And sometimes it's very hard to get the kids there because the parents don't have cars or don't have transportation or don't have time or whatever the situation is. So we're like, why aren't we putting a medical company inside our school to be able to support the kids when they get to school if they need something? It's very simple. Like, let's solve the problem. So I'd love to know, like, how did it go the first round? Obviously, you were there for 4 years. You have a system. You have, you know, a team that you built with it. You still have the same team. You're using the same processes, but it's a bigger race. Like, you know, what? I love watching your posts, so it's pretty interesting to me.
Well, when I ran for the Senate, my wife and I did quite a bit of soul searching before we said yes, because the effort to recruit me to run in 2016 started in 2015. And Mary and I had just gotten back from a deeply moving and profound experience where we'd spent 12 days in Israel and had a chance to walk the steps of Jesus and his life. And we got back, and less than a week later, we were being recruited to run for the Senate. So we said no for the first 2 months. And then through a lot of soul searching, we said yes. Built a team. We ended up winning in 2016. And we actually had more votes than any other Republican senator in the state of Minnesota. And for a first-time rookie, that felt pretty good. But in the Senate, what I learned was there was just not a great deal of intellectual curiosity. There was more an interest in protecting oneself from being criticized. And there was always a lot of attention paid to whenever it was that your next election would take place, whether it was a two-year term or a four-year term. That was a huge deal. So that was really disappointing and disillusioning for me. So I felt like I got quite a bit of work done. I worked hard on trying to increase transparency in terms of the healthcare field, and particularly in terms of the pricing of our services and the pricing of drugs. And why is it that Americans pay 5 to 10 times more than what other first world country citizens pay for the same drug? And we got some stuff done. But overall, the amount of time and effort that went into getting problems solved was just ludicrous in terms of a return on investment. And so I decided not to run for re-election. And then COVID hit. And COVID really pushed me to the front of the line, because unwittingly, I had no idea that raising my hand and challenging the Minnesota Department of Health, that they were asking me to, if you will, compromise and corrupt the way I completed death certificates. When I said, hey, you don't want to do that, you're going to disqualify a lot of the data we rely on, I had no idea that I would get crickets for a response. And 2 months later, my medical license would be investigated. So getting pushed to the front of the line was a big deal. All of a sudden, my life was upside down. I was on national news programs like the Ingram Angle and Tucker Carlson and Rush Limbaugh and Dr. Drew and things. And it was all simply because I applied my natural skepticism to the context of what I was encountering. And I was trying to ask questions. And that's all it took to turn my life upside down. And then I ended up getting recruited to run for governor. And my wife and I probably struggled with that decision for 6 to 12 months before we finally said, okay, this is something we need to do. This is not the time for us to stand on the sidelines.
So I've been asked to run for a couple of different positions. And as a retired pro athlete, I speak well, from what I've been told. It's interesting. And I've told people, it's challenging to get things done in some positions. I think I'd run for one of potentially maybe three or four: mayor, because you oversee the whole thing; governor; sheriff, because I'm a deputy sheriff, but I do it part time now; or president. Like there's only a few positions that you have a lot of oomph. And I love that you saw that, so that you can, when you become governor, you can really apply those things that you learned from one position to the next. What are three things you see you need from where you're at today to November? What are those stepping stones that you guys need and support from now to then?
Well, any campaign needs to have a certain, if you will, platform from which to disseminate the message. And that's hard. And I think President Trump showed America that you can run a campaign and speak to the nation without necessarily being dependent on conventional legacy media. You can use social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and TikTok. And we've done that, but we need to keep growing it, because there is so much bias in legacy media. Obviously, well, I shouldn't maybe say obviously, but I think many experts would say that at least 75% of legacy media leans left, and perhaps something less than 25% leans right. And so depending upon what your narrative or your message is, you may well not have equal access to having potential voters hear your message. So that's one thing we need, is we need that opportunity to disseminate our message. And we have 500,000 people following us on Facebook and Twitter every day. And we have 100,000 people that have joined our email team. But that's critical. The second thing is money. You always need money. And in Minnesota, typically, the Democrats will have about 5 to 10 times more money, more dollars than the Republicans will have. So that's an ongoing challenge. And then the last thing and the most important thing is you need supporters. And the supporters are in Minnesota, and as in many places in the country and the world, we have such wonderful people in Minnesota. They're thoughtful, they're engaged, they pay attention. The problem is politics is so darn dirty that, I don't know if you remember the quote where Harry Reid, I think it made some false comment about Mitt Romney, and I think it was in 2012. And they said, well, you know, what you said about him wasn't true at all. How do you feel about having lied? And Harry Reid shrugged his shoulder and said, it worked, didn't it? And I think that that's the attitude of a lot of politicians, is if they say it and they can't really be held accountable for it, regardless of the fact that it's false, they'll run with it. And I think that's hard. So we need supporters that are willing to make certain that they stay with us, because I've told many supporters, by the time November comes around, they will have heard that I've had 15 different wives and I've got horns on my forehead. And I need them to know that that's not the case. And so between dollars and supporters and a way to get the message out, those are the three biggest things we need. Our website is drscottjensen.com. And a lot of people have said that that's really helped them. And they can just go to drscottjensen.com and they hear and read a lot about what our positions are. But I think we also need people like you, Daniel, that are willing to ask hard questions, get people engaged and involved, so that, if you will, the whole campaign process can be transparent and there can be a relationship built between the voter and the candidate.
Smart. When people support you and they jump on, what do they usually do? And also, when they do it, obviously you have a team that, you know, supports them on walking or telling a message or social or that sort of thing. And how do you get involved with the local team or local teams around different cities? Like, how do you really pour into local teams, wisdom, mentors, that sort of thing? And then when you become governor, will you continue to do that?
Well, I think I'm obsessive compulsive. So I definitely do best when I dot the I's and cross the T's and check the boxes and make sure that if I said I was going to do something, I do it. So I probably respond in one way or another, read, digest, respond to maybe some 500 emails a day, maybe a little less than that, and maybe a couple hundred text messages. And probably it's unusual for me not to be on the phone at least 25, 50 calls a day. So we've got a team of about 12 people that really do a tremendous amount of coordinating, deciphering messages, sifting through them. And they usually take those things that they deal with in a given day and they put those to three or four people. And those three or four people are in contact with me every day. And sometimes it'll be something where I can do a 2 or 3 minute video and speak to an issue that's weighing heavy on the hearts of a lot of people. We'll do it that way. Otherwise, we'll put out a message that everybody can digest and they'll all have the same message. Sometimes I'll get on the phone, and in Minnesota, we've got 8 congressional districts. So in my head, I've got this team where I can call 2 or 3 people in each congressional district and see if they have any questions on an emerging issue. And so that's the way I stay in touch there. I think that, you know, you mentioned before, Daniel, mayor and governor, those are executive positions. Those kinds of positions have their own special needs. And one of the needs is you need to be able to be a cheerleader. You need to be able to be an ambassador. You need to be able to be a delegator. And you need to be able to make sure that you're giving enough attaboys, attagirl to people so that they feel appreciated and motivated to do more. And I do a lot of that. I try to use my text messaging. I try to at least every day send out a handful of positive complimentary messages to people that over the prior 48 to 72 hours, I had some way or another come across something they'd done or they'd read or they'd written or they'd performed. And so I just don't think you can ever do enough, but you just have to keep on trying and you hope that that you touch people. But I think it's also important to make sure that when you're doing those things, do them even if all the lights are out. Do them even if nobody can see you. Do them just because they're the right thing to do. Because those will be the moments that really identify who you are. When nobody is watching, are you willing to go open the door for someone or go help someone pick up all the little spilled sugar packets off of their table at the restaurant that they so clumsily tipped over and now are embarrassed about? Whatever you can do, the best ones are when no one else is watching.
So I think it's really interesting because in our organization, we have about 60 team members, and it's interesting that I ask them for advice a lot more than they ask me these days, because I find like our dean, so we have five deans, let's say, we ask them and we ask student advisors, we ask the teachers and tutors, what do you need? How do you get that job done? And we train them to what we call ask for support if they need it. But we reach out so much and continue to understand what the needs are from them versus us understanding like top down how to push policy. I mean, there's policies obviously with Department of Ed or, you know, with other groups, but it's interesting to be able to see how I can bring new innovative ideas from 60 minds versus us just having a core team of four or five people to tell 60 people what to do. How do you see other leaders throughout your, you know, professional life where it's more of the top down versus like understanding what the people want or what works on the ground? Because I'm not in the school every day anymore. I used to be, but it's a whole different thing when you're an executive and you have a management role and you're like what I call leader builder versus a leader or a boss or a manager.
Well, there's always that balance. And I think Teddy Roosevelt once said that in times of difficult decision-making, the best thing you can do is the right thing. The next best thing you can do is the wrong thing. But the worst thing you can do is nothing. And I think that's one side of it. You don't want to be stuck in a position where nothing's happening. You're better off doing something and failing so you can learn from the failure and get better. I think on the other side, you want to elevate the word nimble, because you always want to make certain that, okay, you do something over here, but you have to be nimble enough that if it turns out it's not the right thing, then change. And I think the way you do that, that process of balancing, not doing nothing and staying nimble, involves open channel of communication. And the only way that's going to happen is if in your organization, you try to have less top down or bottom up and more horizontal. You want to say, okay, we've made our decision. We've created our strategy. Now let's tip the structure from here over to here so that we're back and forth for the next few days, next few weeks, next few months, as we watch to see, did we make the right decision? Did we make a decision that operationally works? And I think the only way you can stay nimble is it's got to be horizontal. If people are fearful that they don't dare do something in a vertically structured setting, it'll be all clutched up. You won't get the kind of immediate communication you need. You'll be stuck. Huh. It's sort of like if you're like this, if you got it vertical, then the whole thing can fall apart if whoever's on top doesn't bother to look in the rear view mirror to make sure there's someone behind. Because if there's nobody following you in your rear view mirror, you're not leading. You're just noise. So you have to do everything you can to make sure that your followers are following. And the reason they're following is because they know that if they need to run to the front of the line and have a conversation with you, they can do it. And they can do it if you're on a level field. They can't do it in this kind of setting where your office is on the 18th floor and all the worker bees are on the 15th floor and the elevator only goes to 16 floors.
Yeah. So that was the easy part, right? Like management, politics. So I want to dive in real quick. I have a 17-month-old. This is him, little cute guy right here. And I want some advice. You have three kids, you have a wife, you've been married a while. I've been with Deanna for about 3 years now, and she's an amazing wife. How'd you raise your kids right?
Well, I think that the first thing I would say is that let's talk about what's not good to do in trying to raise a child between 0 and 5 years of age, because, you know, a kid under the age of five is different than parenting a 15-year-old. But I would say under five, it's not about negotiation. It's not about transaction. Parents don't get to be addicted to approval or love from their child. Their child may be angry with them. Their child might not give them a good night kiss or a good night hug. That doesn't mean the parent should change anything at all. That's just a child's awkward way of trying to express themselves, that they're going to withhold something that they've seen gives their mom or dad pleasure, whether it be a hug or a kiss. So I don't think parents can let that kind of urge to get in the way of doing what's necessary. So let's talk about what's necessary. I would say first, accountability. If you tell your child not to do something and they do it, there's got to be some accountability, whether it's a timeout, whether it's no treat, whether it's some deprivation of what they normally might have expected and wanted. There has to be accountability. I think the second thing is, I think there's got to be consistency. And I used to do quite a bit of my practice with counseling, and oftentimes it was marital counseling. But a lot of times what was really troubling the marriage wasn't finances, wasn't religion, wasn't sex. It was parenting. And oftentimes what was happening is the parents weren't consistently getting on the same page. One parent would say this, this, and this. And the other parent would come along and say, oh no, wipe those away. It's this, this, and this. You've got to be consistent. And that means that when the kids are in bed at night, you got to spend some time talking about, gee, when you did this, I felt like you're undercutting me because I had said this and you said this. There's got to be consistent communication between the parents. The kids are smart and they will work one parent against the other. It's part of the way their brain is wired. Human nature helps us learn without a whole lot of help how to negotiate for ourselves. So I think there's got to be consistency. And then there's got to be unconditional love. You can't, as a parent, sort of tantalize your child with being loved or not being loved. It always has to be there. So I think accountability in terms of the kid's got to do what the parent says. And the parent will modify that as the child grows into understanding and responsibility and more consistently doing what was expected or hoped for. I don't care if you're talking about potty training or cleaning their own room or not spilling their food or not turning their glass of milk over. But I think there's got to be accountability. There's got to be consistency in terms of how you discipline, how you love, how you encourage between the parents. And then lastly, love has got to be unconditional. The kid has got to go to bed every night knowing that he or she is loved by his or her parents.
I find a lot of parents get frustrated today. Oh, yeah. They take outside world, bring it into the house, which isn't easy to understand emotional and like belief intelligences, right? Because we're not taught a lot of how to love ourselves. They were, we're kind of told to, I don't know. I mean, we're not even told. I mean, some people aren't even told to go love other people today, right? So I think it's hard to find how to love ourselves. I had to learn because I went to juvenile hall and got into fights and beat people up and got punched in the face for 10 years. And I figured out how to love myself because I didn't want to punch anybody else. I was like, I'm done. I'm good. But I think that's hard. What would you say? I mean, there's a lot going on in this world, right? Whether, financial or medical or whatever else is happening. What kind of advice would you give the parents that are, and a lot of your parents probably in your state, I see a lot of parents, they come into our schools. They're just a lot going on in their life. What kind of advice would you give them on how to focus on that unconditional love piece and how to really bring that into their kids? Because older kids necessarily aren't going to do everything that a parent said to do.
I think the older the child gets, the more you have to turn to questions rather than answers or proclamations. Stephen Covey wrote a book about 7 habits of effective people a long time ago. And I thought one of them was, one of his habits that he highlighted was particularly powerful. And that was, seek first to understand, then to be understood. And I think parents need to do that with their child, particularly as the child grows older. You talk to the 10-year-old, you talk to the 12-year-old, you talk to the 16-year-old new driver, you talk to the 18-year-old. I think for me, the world in which I live, so much goodness comes out of asking the right questions. So I would say, ask the questions. Keep trying to learn, because that's really going to be the, that's going to be the secret sauce, is ask the questions. And then I think there's a lot of value in role playing. And I think you find that it's pretty easy. So if you're talking to a 14-year-old daughter, put the phones away, turn the TV off, but flip the roles. Ask the 14-year-old daughter, put yourself in my shoes, and I'll try to put myself in your shoes. And let's redo the conversation we just had this morning that was so difficult for both of us. And you go first as a parent. You become the 14-year-old daughter, and you do your level best to argue their case or to put out their perspective on the table. That's what they teach you in law school. If you can't argue both sides of the case, the defense or the prosecution, you really don't know the case. In medicine, we always say, if you can't answer a medical student's question as to why you do something, you don't understand well enough why you did something. I think we have to do the same thing here. Be the 14-year-old daughter. Demonstrate to the 14-year-old daughter that you really do understand their perspective. The fact of the matter is, you understand it so well that you can play their role, and you can maybe even make their case better than they could. And once you do that, hopefully they'll be able to play your role and start to understand that you come from a different place. So I really think asking questions and doing role playing can help, but obviously it's age dependent.
I really like the advice. That's some of the best advice I've heard in a long time, with the shifting the role playing with your kids. That's really good stuff. I ask everybody because I find that how people treat kids a lot of the time is who they are as a human. If they get frustrated with little ones, like at what level are you going to stop getting frustrated? Or if you're happy with little ones, but you're not happy with big ones, like what's going on? Like, where's that human inside of you that really connects with people? And if, when I bring speakers into our schools, I can vet people out a lot faster with my kids than I can with some of my adults sometimes, because the kids will see right through bigger humans.
Well, there's an adage that I use in the world of business and the world of politics, and it's this one: whatever you incentivize, you'll get more of. And it works with parenting too. I mean, if you incentivize a kid not abiding by what he or she had said 10 minutes ago when you said, okay, we're going to brush the teeth, we're going to read 2 books, and we're going to go to bed. And if after the 2 books are read, they get to throw a tantrum, and then because of that, they get a couple of animal cracker cookies or something, you've just incentivized that behavior. So you can rest assured you're going to get more of it tomorrow night.
So you're not for incentivizing behavior. I absolutely love it. We're good. We're good. So I appreciate your time today. I'd love to end on one thing. And I ask this to usually everybody, is what's one thing that you don't have right now that if you had, you know, I'm narrowed down to one, right? That you could make a bigger impact, you know, within your community, your state, or your goals of your medical practice, that sort of thing. So it's open-ended.
I think the one thing I don't have right now that if I did have, I could really make more substantive change would be the bully pulpit of the governor's role in Minnesota. That's why I'm running. I think you can accomplish so much from using your station in life to the maximum benefit. And I think our governor in Minnesota has not been willing to use his bully pulpit to honor the work policemen and women do, to honor people who are frustrated and concerned and anxious about whether or not our election processes are what they were in past decades. Instead, people are sometimes being called names because they dare to ask a question that reflects a discomfort that they genuinely hold inside. I think that we could have our leaders today do it differently. If they could use their bully pulpit, it's okay to ask questions, to seek a stronger recognition of the context in which we live. So much of what went on with COVID, I got myself in hot water because all I was trying to do is just try to provide some context. People came out and said, holy cow, we've got 300 people died of COVID today. And I say to them, well, we have 10,000 people die every day in America. So yes, today, 300 of them die of COVID, but none of them died of influenza. And in many years, we would have had 300 or more people die of influenza in a day in this country. That's context. I think that if we had leaders using their bully pulpit to enhance context, understanding, defend the police, our military, defend those who live in the shadows of life, defend the unborn, if we had more of those people, I think we'd find ourselves able to get along better. And right now, our country is tragically divided, and it's going to take a long time to heal these wounds.
And some good men and some good leaders.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, I appreciate your time. You're a huge blessing. I'd love to meet you at some point. Love to come up to your beautiful state. Again, I've been there before, and I'm excited for the next eight months and to see results and then the impact that you make.
Thank you so much, Daniel, and God bless you. And it takes all of us to make a world. So let's keep trying to make a world.
Sounds great. Have an amazing day. You guys, significance breeds success every single week right here. Check me out. You go to danielpeter.com or significancebreedsuccess.com. Thank you.